Dean, thanks so much for joining us. This is so nice.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
What did it feel like yesterday when you were interviewing Vladimir Putin and the other heads of state?
Man, listen, it was probably one of the best moments in my career, I would assume. Like, you know, you don't get that chance.
Were you nervous?
At the beginning, yes, but we had the chance to sit together like probably 30 minutes before the interview. So that was, you know, it broke the ice. He was chill. We talked about Kazan and Abu Dhabi and Bahrain and then the other presidents came in, and then it was like a very chill talk about, you know, tea and coffee and his preferences and all of these things.
You know what's interesting? You were sitting there shooting questions at Mr. Putin and the presidents of Indonesia and South Africa and Bahrain and
China.
And not the presidents, but heads of state, leaders of
the vice premier of China.
Correct. And you were talking to them for as long as you wanted to, for as long as there were things to talk about, without prepared questions, and there were no time limits that they had established. The reason I'm making a big deal out of this, people watching us right now are going, yeah? Well, guess what? I come from a country, the United States of America, where you're lucky if you can get 5 minutes in an interview, and everything is written down and prepared, and they have a prepared
talking points.
Yeah.
Yeah, canned interviews.
Yeah. So, but wait, but you're in Russia. This is the place where it's supposed to be state media, communist control. Nobody's allowed to. There's no real journalism here, right?
Listen, I mean, I don't want to sound like, you know, playing propaganda for the Russians.
Right.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned as a journalist.
There's plenty wrong with the Russians.
I mean, yeah. you decide, you judge, you, yeah. I mean, draw your own conclusions. I will tell you what happened. I will tell you facts, and you, as, you know, your viewers will decide if this is propaganda or not.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been asked to ask or not to ask a question.
Hmm.
Zero. The meetings with Dmitry Peskov, the president's media advisor, were about, you know, the normal architecture of an interview. Like, these are the topics. They want to make sure that I'm aware of the latest developments that within which Russia is involved or playing a role. They just wanted to make sure that I'm educated enough about the topics.
Of course.
And that's fair enough.
But the proof is in the pudding.
I mean, nothing.
But the proof is in the pudding. You sat there and put Vladimir Putin's feet to the fire. You asked him, what are you going to do about Iran? You have a commitment to Iran. It's a BRICS country. You have a relationship
with
them.
More than that.
Yeah.
I told him, the war is breaking your economy. It goes all the way against his narrative. Mm-hmm. All the way. I said, you know, these are your numbers. This is your scorecard. You're not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Any economist looking at these numbers would say that, you know, you are in bad shape.
To which
your economy is in bad shape, and the war is killing your economy. He took it back, and he, you know, he defended his numbers. He defended his narrative. He defended the facts from his perspective.
Listen, he argues, you know, unemployment's at 7%. That's not bad, considering they used to be somewhere between, you know, 15 and 21.
And he did
about
that
a decade
comparatively,
ago, right?
Comparatively to how the global economy is performing. And and he thinks, giving the context, he's comfortable with what he achieved. He's not happy.
Right.
It's not what he would have wanted to be, the numbers. I mean,
Right.
But it is what it is.
When you asked there were two answers that you got from the leader from Bahrain and the vice premier of South Africa, and it was about secondary sanctions. And I like that question because you said you guys have made a commitment to Russia. But if the United States says to you, secondary sanctions, if you continue doing business with Russia, we're going to sanction you for doing business with Russia.
Exactly.
Even though you haven't committed the sin, we think they have, which of course is arguable whether it's a sin or not anyway. But still, you kind of put their feet to the fire. Bahrain said, well, we'll continue doing what we do, but we always want to be neutral. South Africa said, yes, we'll continue to do.
Exactly.
A promise is a promise, and we're going to stay firm with Russia. I thought that was interesting.
I think the whole answers of the vice president of South Africa was really interesting for me. It was like, you know, it's a country that I'm not educated about.
Right.
And he was very good in his you know general answers. In that answer in particular, it aligns with the DNA of his country. It aligns with the defiance tone of South Africa these days. Mm. But I believe that the other part of the question, when I asked about the reputational price, that sometimes when you ally with Russia, when you deepen the relationship with Russia, there is a reputational price that is attached to that, because Russia is being, you know, character assassinated day in, day out.
Yeah.
Right? So it feels like you are with the bad guys, not with the good guys, with the evil guys, not with the good guys. So
can I give you an example of what the problem is? You and I are sitting in my hotel room, right? And
big hotel room. I mean, don't be humble.
Yeah. I was just in my room down the hall, and I turned on the TV, and I was watching a channel called France 24.
Yeah.
And they just went on the air and used your interview and said, yesterday, Vladimir Putin told an interviewer, told you, that Russia owns all of Ukraine. Do you hear him?
This is not what he said.
Of course it's not what he said.
This is not what he said.
But why, but why are they saying that?
Listen, I'm not in a place to...
I don't even know what the hell France 24 is.
To attack another channel that we have colleagues with, I respect them, but on factual basis, I mean, you draw the conclusion or the judgment.
It's a lie.
On a factual basis...
He didn't say that.
This is not what he said.
He didn't come in anywhere near to say
that. It was a counterfactual, a rhetorical example he gave.
Exactly.
That's what it was.
Right.
I asked him, how... I mean, your army is advancing beyond the frontiers of the four, areas or districts that you think these are Russian.
Is that true?
I mean, yeah. I mean, he said, listen, if you know...
Because they don't have a deal.
Based on what you just said, I should take the whole of Ukraine because we think that Ukraine is Russian from, you know, from A to Z.
Which is a historical reference.
It was a rhetorical kind of anecdotal.
But French 24, whatever the hell that's... They do this all the time. They just lie through their teeth.
I know I'm speaking to Russia Today and to a journalist, a fine colleague in Russia Today.
Yeah.
But let me forget the context of where
Please.
We are talking now. One of the major problems in geopolitics today is the level of intended misunderstanding between global powers, between leading global powers. That intended misunderstanding is poisoning the conversation, is creating a false context.
I don't understand. What is intended? What did you call it again?
Anyone who is reading the script of the interview would have noticed that he didn't say that.
Exactly.
I mean, he didn't say that,
exactly.
Simply.
And right? I'm not perfect. I make a crap load of mistakes.
But
that doesn't look like a mistake to me.
This is you editing this interview to make me look like saying something that I didn't say.
Correct.
Okay.
Which is what they did to you.
Based on what you're telling me, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what they did.
Yeah. Why do they do that?
That is unfortunate.
Why? I mean, you know...
Because if you are a villain, I need to prove every single day that you are the villain. And if you are not living up to the villain status that I projected on you,
right,
then I have to make you say things that will prove my, you know, predetermined judgment of you as a villain. That's what it is.
Can I tell you something else? They didn't show him saying...
I said the most important thing, the smartest statement in my life, and you jump like...
Come back.
Oh, my God.
Go ahead. They want to make a villain.
No, I cannot repeat it.
So, but my point is this. Not only did they not get it right,
okay,
they didn't even play the video of you saying it. They just said what he said.
Yeah.
Which makes it, I think, even worse.
Listen, they have a predetermined image of how Putin should look like to the outside world.
Mm.
And they would do anything to maintain, to stay consistent with that, you know, predetermined image of him.
Putin is in a pickle, though, isn't he, with Iran? Because, after all, there's nothing that Putin wants more than a good relationship with the United States. And if he can give to Trump something on Iran by helping negotiate something, I don't even know what, then maybe Trump will throw him getting rid of sanctions or something to that effect. What do you make of that? I think you were trying to get to that yesterday when you were talking to him.
I think honestly speaking, that there is a high level of ambiguity and uncertainty around Iran, that he doesn't want to commit to a certain position that will be taken against him later on, like a few weeks down the road. This is one thing. Second thing, he is actively involved in a diplomatic effort to defuse this problem, right? Working with the Emiratis, working with some, because if you think about it, he is in a very unique position. He's friends with the Israelis, friends with the Iranians, friends with the Chinese,
and trying to be
reasonable with the Americans. And the Europeans is a different story. But I mean, he's in a very unique position to play that role, tied in to other people in the same position, like Mohammed bin Zayed in Abu Dhabi, like Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. So he was basically protecting whatever he is doing at this moment to defuse this problem, instead of, you know, bragging about, you know, total surrender, whatever it is. I mean, he's...
Let's listen real quick to how he answered your question. Here it is.
I would like to draw your attention to the fact that almost 2 million people from the former Soviet Union and the Russian Federation live in Israel. It is almost a Russian-speaking country today. Secondly, we have traditionally developed very good, trusting, friendly, and allied relations with the Arab and Islamic world. And due to the fact that we have more than 15%, well, about 15% of the population is Muslim, we are observers of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. You see, this is also a factor here. Moreover, based on our well-known level of relations with Israel and our improving relations with the United States, we have stated to Israel and U.S. President Donald Trump that we are fulfilling our duties in Iran based on our understanding of Iran's right to peaceful atomic energy and based on the fact that we are acting entirely within international norms. And we ask that the safety of our personnel be ensured.
So he says, at the end of that answer, he mentions relationship with Israel, and he mentions that he's trying to reestablish relationship with Washington. While he's telling you that he has a relationship with Iran, sounds like he's playing all three sides of the coin.
Sure. One of the things that I've learned in this career is that emotions is a very disruptive geopolitical power, and people underestimate that. Iran is a manifestation of emotion. It's the Persian pride. Israel is a manifestation of, you know, victimhood, historic.
Yeah.
Russia is a manifestation of anxiety. This is an anxious country. Anxiety is in the DNA of the country.
Yeah.
When you humiliate this country as much as you did since 1991, you don't expect other reactions. And this is very important. People tend to, and you humiliate him now by taking his sound bites out of context and making him sound like he said something he didn't say, basically, right? So,
which is what France 24 did.
Whoever, I mean.
Yeah, well, that's what it was. I was just watching him. That's what it said on the screen.
Countries do not even, I mean, not only countries, like big powers do not react in a good way to
being
to exclusion.
Yeah.
And Russia was excluded and humiliated. It's not me saying that. It's not Russia today saying that. It is the architects of the U.S. containment strategy. It's Henry Kissinger saying that. It is George Kennan saying that. When you put the NATO on the doorstep, when you park your tanks on the doorstep of Russia, you don't expect Russia to just say, you know, I don't like that, and then just sit back. Superpowers do not react in that way. Even kids do not react that way. So it's just an instinct that we you know what's the tragedy of this war?
No.
Is that it could have not happened.
It is
a failure of imagination.
Ukraine.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Russia was provoked.
Russia was provoked all the way, and those who provoked Russia knew that this will happen, but they decided to turn a blind eye and say, no, they will not do it. No, they will not do it.
Here's a tough question I'm going to ask you, because I know it would be fair.
We don't do advocacy. That's the word.
Advocacy.
Yeah.
As a human being, are you bothered by the actions of Israel? And how do you deal with that as a journalist?
Listen, I'm coming from a very, you know, multi-layered cultural background. I'm Arab, I'm Muslim, I'm a father. I mean, you know, multiple identities.
Like most of us.
So when you look at a tragedy like Palestine, you cannot but feel that this is a failure of humanity before anything else. Mm. It's a failure of us as human beings to be able to deliver something that is deliverable.
Yeah.
It is not something impossible to deliver, which is some sort of peace between two peoples fighting on the same land. But I mean, context matters. I cannot but look at the victimization narrative of the Palestinians without looking at what happened on October 7. And I cannot take October 7 as the only prism or lens to look at what's happening. And I cannot say that you cannot. It's very. One of the failures of our intellectual life is trying to fight over pain. Whose pain is bigger than the other, and whose pain to prioritize pain? Right? You know, this pain is a class A. This pain is class B. This exercise is taking place in both communities. The Palestinians, they don't want to see the pain of the Israelis. The Israelis, they don't want to see the pain of the Palestinians. And there are reasonable voices on both sides
except, except for one thing.
What's that?
You have Goliath and you have baby Samson, or whatever you want to call it.
We have two Goliaths, actually. And baby Samson is a tool for another Goliath, which is Iran. Don't forget that. Never forget the dynamics. Context matters. We had the chance to have peace in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Back then, the alliance was between Iran, Hamas, Jihad, Islamic Jihad, and on the other side, you had the Torah fanatics, those who killed Yitzhak Rabin. So it was, from day one, it was the extreme right on the Islamic side, the extreme right on the Jewish side, aligning together and pushing. I mean, think about Bibi Netanyahu.
Yeah.
Since 1996, Bibi Netanyahu, the forces that contributed to the rise of Bibi Netanyahu, who are they?
Extremist,
Hamas,
right-wing.
Iran, Jihad Islami, Hezbollah, Ben-Gvir, the Ben-Gvirs of that world. I mean, think that Ben-Gvir was the guy who took off the ornament from Rabin's car before he was killed and said, we've reached your mm-hmm. car, we can reach you at any point of choice. So it's not a coincidence that these guys, you know, converged 20 or 30 years later.
Can Iran win this war?
I don't think so. And I think that it is a disaster if it does, and it's a disaster if it doesn't. We are in a very, very tricky moment by which, you know, looking at this crisis and the, using the lens of victory and defeat, and without taking into consideration the impact of whichever scenario it goes, mm-hmm. Does the Gulf need another war? Do we need another failed state in the region? Do we need continuous war? All of these scenarios are disastrous to the country where I live in, where I build my life, my kids' life, my future. So put all the emotions on the side, no matter where I stand on Iran. I'm not a big fan of Iran, but the matter of the fact is the following. Another war in the Middle East is a disaster to everyone.
Final question. I've never interviewed Vladimir Putin, but I'm kind of fascinated by the guy, and I watch a lot of his interviews. My friend Tucker interviewed him, and we had a long conversation about that.
Our friend Tucker.
Tucker told me about it, and I thought it was kind of interesting when he... So you've interviewed him on several occasions now. You've been with President Putin on several occasions. The West doesn't even know who this man is because they're not allowed to know. His sound bites aren't played, and he's only made fun of on Saturday Night Live. And other comedy shows. So my question to you is, since you've been with him and he's answered your questions, you've had conversations, can you give us a sense of what's behind the man?
Behind the man is a very reasonable and rational leader, and a very personal, mature ego, but a very wounded national ego.
Wounded?
National ego.
Why wounded?
Because if you take context again matters. If you take what happened and since 1999, since Kosovo all the way to what's happening now, Russia feels that it is being intentionally, diminished or humiliated or cornered. Again, superpowers do not react nicely to these anxieties.
Usually when you do that to somebody, they get a chip on their shoulder. Does he have a chip on his shoulder?
What do you mean?
Chip on the shoulder means that he feels like you're messing with him and he's not going to let you do that. In other words...
They are messing with him. Yeah. It's again, it's not me saying that. It's not Russia Today saying that. It's Henry Kissinger saying that.
Yeah.
It's George Kennan saying that. These are the architects.
And you sense that in him? You sense that in, when, I mean...
He doesn't want any... I mean, when you talk to him, when you tell him that you are changing the global order, he would tell you, no, I'm not. I'm not. This is larger than me. Mm-hmm. All what I'm doing is that I'm taking note of what is actually changing in the global order and trying to take advantage of that. Mm. Period. I mean, you cannot park your tanks on the doorstep of Russia and expect Russia not to react.
Or the doorstep.
I mean, unless you are, you know, a total idiot.
Yeah.
So basically...
And that's what NATO did in Ukraine.
100%. 100%.
Yeah.
And you park your tanks, you keep lying about Russia, you keep lying about the man, you keep humiliating him and his country and. I mean...
When you push somebody back against a corner, eventually they can only go
level,
one way.
If you look at the level of hypocrisy in the European Union, in their trade relationship with Russia, so they have sanctions. You don't have to trade with Russia. You cannot do this. You cannot do that. And then they take all their trade through a conduit, through a third party, and then you send them back. You're talking about, hundreds of billions of dollars. So why do you do that? I mean, why do you do that?
No, you're right. It's tough to look at it and not come to that conclusion. But that's kind of where we are.
I think now, with Putin in place, with Trump in place, you have two reasonable men, non-ideologues in so many ways, that they will be able to, improve this relationship.
What's taking so long?
I think history, I think war, I think, the pendulum was moved all the way in terms of, the character assassination that happened to Putin doesn't really allow for much space for dialogue. But I think Trump can, he's a disruptive force. He's like,
So you're
he's a startup in nature.
You're encouraged by the conversations and you're positive and you do believe that they will come up with some kind of accord that will at least reestablish a relationship between Russia and United States.
I think they can. I think they should. And I think any reasonable man in Washington should look at the map. Huh. And see how big Russia is, 11 time zones. And you cannot treat that as, you lost the war, so we won the war, and that's it,
There's only one problem with what you said. Reasonable man in Washington.
I think so. I mean, I say something, you can put a beep on it. But you cannot tell a country like Russia off.
Yeah.
Superpowers do not off.
Yeah. And with that, we conclude the interview. You know what? Thank you for doing this.
This was a
really great conversation.
Thank you so much.
I feel like I'm talking to a colleague. You're a journalist, so am I. I feel like it's not so much like I'm I don't talk to you the way I talk to a head of state. I talk to you like I talk to somebody who's a buddy who's in the business.
We need more of these conversations, to be honest. Social media has put so much pressure on people like us to, stop these manicured scripted conversations because it will not go anywhere. It will not
exactly.
Have the Teflon effect. It will not stick.
Hire smart people who've lived a good life, have experience, have read enough books, put them together, and have them have a smart conversation, and you'll get more out of that than most newscasts can deliver.
Within a better AC, obviously.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good stuff.